This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, Reckoning with Torture, a collage of readings from the testimonies of torture victims and witnesses, introduced by Robert Redford, and then a reading featuring author Paul Auster. But first,
living in the times of Zero Dark 30. Art doesn't exist in a vacuum. It is created in and expresses itself in a time and place and impacts us emotionally and intellectually. It shapes public opinion. Leni Riefenstahl was a female film pioneer who directed the 1935 Triumph of the Will, a brilliant technical and emotional manipulation of cinematography to glorify Nazi military power. I'm comparing Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark 30 to The Triumph of the Will insofar as it sanitizes the mechanisms of and consequences of torture, completely dehumanizing those upon whom it was used, and depicts it as a means to eradicate a threat to American safety and security, locating Osama bin Laden, taking him out, albeit erroneously, even by government account. And in so doing, the film chose to ignore the facts. It legitimizes torture. But we're going to probe deeper to understand the dimensions of the use of torture still, and the legal implications of failing to repudiate it as a society. I'm pleased to speak with Alexander Abdo, staff attorney with the ACLU National Security Project, to discuss the implications of Zero Dark 30 because of its praise and multiple nominations in the Academy Awards.
Thank you so much for having me, Mimi. Very happy to be here.
Let's just begin at the start. Was torture an effective tool in the hunt for bin Laden?
The most we know about that question comes from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the members of that committee who've been engaging in a several year-long effort to review the CIA's torture program to determine the scope of it and whether it was effective. Three members of that committee have publicly come out as disagreeing very strongly with the suggestion in the movie Zero Dark 30 that torture was effective. They've said very publicly that torture was not effective, that it did not lead to Osama bin Laden. But I'd like to take a step back because I hate to get into that question first before making clear that I think that question is a red herring. Torture has been criminal in this country for a very long time. There's been an international prohibition against torture embodied in a treaty that we've ratified in this country called the Convention Against Torture. And both our domestic prohibition, our criminalization of torture, and the international prohibition make clear that there are no exceptions. Torture is illegal no matter whether we happen to think it works in a particular moment, because it does offend human dignity. It is so anti-American in what it does that it's really irrelevant, this question of whether torture works. But if we must be dragged into that question, I think those in the position most knowledgeable to shed light on that question are the members of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, who put together a 6,000-page report that is still secret, but we've heard some of its conclusions from the members working on it in their public statements.
To go back, because I don't think that certainly we've thoroughly fleshed out the issues around abuse and torture that took place in the prisons of Abu Ghraib and Gitmo. How are we to understand that within the context of your expression of the illegality of torture?
Both the CIA's program of detention and interrogation, which utilized the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, and the military's program, which relied on a different set of techniques, but ones that were also cruel and at times torture, violated the law. And it's not just me saying that. President Obama, when he took office, made clear that the techniques that had been used in the past violated our ideals as a country and our laws, and vowed to put an end to them, and in fact did move forward. The problem with the reaction of Obama and others to the mistreatment that took place is that it simply put an end to it, but it didn't make clear, or clear enough anyway, that is a path that our country should never go down again. And the clearest way to send that statement would have been to investigate fully those who are responsible, not just for implementing the program, but for ordering it from the very as it stands, the only people who faced any form of accountability for the use of torture are generally low-level interrogators, those who are essentially were followers And while we know from Nuremberg that just following orders is not a defense, there's a sense in which the low-level interrogators have been scapegoated by the senior officials who are in fact responsible for the use of torture by both the CIA and the military. And so I think it's important that we recognize the limitations of what happened when President Obama took office. Though he quite importantly put an end to the use of torture, he, in his words, elected to look forward and not backward. And in that sense, to leave us in a state where the question of torture's effectiveness and the question of whether we should be torturing is one that's still the subject of political debate, even though it really should not be.
Well, let's even push that a little further then. The Guantanamo military commissions were created in part to hide the government's illegal torture program while permitting the use of information obtained through torture. Now, it's harder now, but not impossible, for coerced evidence to be used in the proceedings, and the government still wants to hide from the public what it did to prisoners in CIA and military custody.
That's right. You know, the military commissions have gotten better over time, but they're still, their defining characteristic, if you will, is that they accommodate types of evidence that would not be admissible in federal court. And I think the most problematic aspect of them currently is that the government has sought in the commissions to classify the detainees' own recollections of their mistreatment by the government. And, you know, while there is evidence of torture already public, there's still a significant amount of evidence that hasn't yet been publicly aired. Among that is the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence's 6,000-page report, but also very important are the accounts by the detainees themselves, the ones who are actually subjected to that mistreatment.
Why can't we suggest that the suspension of habeas corpus, of individual rights and constitutional checks on executive power, is valid under circumstances such as 9/11?
Our system was really, you know, founded on what this notion that you mentioned, one of checks and balances. The difficulty with it, I think, since 9/11, one of the ways in which our system of checks and balances has been undermined is by excessive reliance by the executive on secrecy. And if you think about our system of checks and balances, it relies very heavily on the ability of both public and the judiciary to perform an oversight role on the actions of the political branches. But when the acts of the political branches are secret, it's very difficult for either judges or for the public to play a meaningful role in overseeing abuses of authority. And since 9/11, we've seen very heavy reliance on this type of secrecy. And that's to say that secrecy doesn't have its place. There are, of course, things that are legitimately secret and things that the government should be permitted to keep secret. But increasingly, we've seen different sorts of secrets than it kept prior to 9/11. It is now keeping secret things that are widely considered illegal, and it is now keeping secret things that really everyone knows. If you think, for example, about the CIA's drone program, it's a program that the CIA and federal court refuses to acknowledge it has any part of, and that's very troubling, this increasing reliance on secrecy. Secrecy is always a difficult problem in a democratic society. So it's particularly important that we find the right balance between legitimate and illegitimate secrecy. And I think we're far from striking the right balance so far.
So would you suggest that the same things hold true as they did for torture relevant to extrajudicial killings? You've kind of alluded to drone strikes, extraordinary renditions, the use of black sites. Is the same applicable standard and perhaps the same jeopardy or juxtaposition to habeas corpus and constitutional checks and balances on executive power applicable?
It's absolutely true to say that all of these programs raise very, very difficult questions about both our values and our laws. And there's obviously great authority in the government when it's responding to actual hostilities on the ground. But there are limits to those authorities, and there are many who like to say that ours is a government of enumerated powers. And we've seen the government reaching over the permissible boundaries time and time again in the years since 9/11. And I think in all of these areas, it's been often difficult to see just how far over the line the government is going, because it refuses often enough to publicly identify or publicly describe the authority that it's claiming. I think in all of these areas. And so in all of these areas, there is a threat to the law that prior to the current emergency was considered the constraint on executive authority that we had all been operating under for quite some time.
Are you troubled by the film, actually, Zero Dark 90, and what you think it depicts in shaping American public attitude and thoughts around, I think, a very fragile democracy and the use of torture? And, as I said, even still the use of torture.
I agree with what you said at the beginning of the show. You said that art has the capability to transform public opinion. And there are people who have viewed Zero Dark 30 through a number of different lenses. Some have viewed it as art, and some have viewed it as more a form of journalism. I think the director and producer have defended it as an honest account of what took place. And to the extent that it purports to be a journalistic account, it's troubling, because it's really a work of fiction and not one of fact. And the problem is that we don't yet have all the facts public. There's a 6,000-page report that I keep mentioning, written by the Intelligence Committee, that relies on 6 million pages of still-secret CIA documents. And until we see that report, or at least the portions of it that can be declassified, we'll be at a loss to have a full account of what took place. But even with that report, I think there are ways in which Zero Dark 30, at least as, you know, if it is a piece of journalism, is troubling. And I don't want to suggest that's how people should be. I think the director and producer have at times defended it or talked about it in those terms. But as a work of art, you know, it's an interesting movie. I think some people like it, some people don't. I think it's worth seeing for viewers, just so they can have an independent view of what the controversy is. But insofar as people are discussing it as a piece of journalism, it's troubling in a number of ways. One, I think, is that it does leave, not for all, but at least for some people, it will leave an impression that torture was important in the hunt for bin Laden. I think we know that that's not true based on the statements from the Intelligence Committee members. But there are also other funny ways in which the movie didn't seem to be accurate to me as someone who spent some time looking at these facts. A lot of people have praised the movie for depicting the torture that was in the movie as very brutal. And I think it's true that the first portion of the movie, which depicts this torture, does show very brutal interrogation. But it was strangely inaccurate in some respects. We now actually have a good number of documents that lay out the way in which the CIA engaged in its torture. And those documents make clear that the torture was meticulously overseen from the top by senior level officials, that there was a doctor in the room when waterboarding was used, which makes you wonder, why should there ever be a doctor in the room when you're interrogating someone if you're convinced that the techniques are safe? But there are details that we know from these memos, such as the presence of a doctor, approval from senior officials in Washington every time they wanted to use a different type of interrogation technique. Those types of details are absent from the movie. The movie leaves the impression that the torture that took place in CIA custody was rogue in some sense, as opposed to this very sterilized and meticulously overseen program, which I think leaves the type of impression that President Bush sought to leave after the abuses at Abu Ghraib were first revealed, which is that torture was aberrational and that it was a result of a small but crusading number of individuals, as opposed to a very concerted effort of those senior officials within our government to subvert the rule of law and to subvert our rules on humane treatment.
Is there any activity being taken by the ACLU or other related or legal organizations to get the release? I know that Dianne Feinstein leads the Senate Intelligence Committee, who is dealing with those highly critical 6,000-page study of the CIA detention and interrogation program. But are there any likelihood that they will see the light of day and continue to inform the public as to what happened and certainly the terrible abuses legally that were part of the process of torture and interrogation?
Well, we publicly called for the committee to have the report declassified, and we'll continue to do so, and we're hopeful that the members of the committee will recognize this is a type of report that was not meant to gather dust on a shelf. This is really one of those tremendously important historical reports that the public has a right to see and that we as Americans must see in order to account for and reckon with the abuses of the 10 years so that we can really move beyond them at least in some respect. So we'll continue to publicly push for it. I'm hopeful that the Senate committee will recognize how important this report is to the public understanding of what took place after 9/11.
Finally, Alexander, is there anything you think that I have left out or that should be apprised of relevant to this discussion and your work?
We touched upon it for a moment, but I want to emphasize, I think, how important the military commissions are as a test of our commitment to the rule of law. I think especially when we're talking about torture. Torture will be, I think, at the forefront of the defense's concern of the case. The case is being prosecuted by the military commissions in Guantanamo Bay, and whether our government has the courage to allow those descriptions of torture to be publicly aired for the first time in a proceeding in which the victims will have a chance to present evidence, I think is an important question, and it's one that will really bear upon the legitimacy of the commissions in the long run. Whether members of the commission, the prosecution, and the government overseeing the commission process have the courage to allow the public airing of the details of torture. If they do, those details will be ugly, and they will cause us trouble as a country, as they should, to learn about these horrific abuses. But I think it's necessary for us to have a full understanding of what took place so that we can move on as a country.
Alexander Abdo, staff attorney with the ACLU National Security Project, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Mimi. It's been a pleasure.
Hi, Mimi Rosenberg. If there's a movie to be made about America's response to 9/11, it is that when the Twin Towers went down, they sent a shockwave through and through the foundation of Western civilization. It rolled back and forth through the entire culture for years, throwing all our institutions off balance. We lost our moral bearings, partly out of fear, but partly out of a failure to understand precisely what was at stake. And as President Obama's amplification of the drone wars show, as long as America is powerful, it will be susceptible to executives who have trouble resisting the abuse of that power. The moral corruption at the heart of Zero Dark 30 is not that it overstates the role of torture, nor is it that it dares to expose truths that make us uncomfortable. Rather, it argues that America's earliest responses to the attacks of 9/11 were the right ones. And in so doing, Catherine Bigelow treats our worst instincts and ugliest actions as virtues and suggests that there is nothing to choose between good and being powerful.
We're spending billions of dollars. We are still no closer to defeating our enemy.
20 detainees recognize that photo.
No birth certificate, no cell phone. The guy's a ghost.
He's right in the inner circle.
The whole world's gonna want in on this.
I want targets.
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
Oh my God, is that what I think it is?
Where was the last time you saw Bin Laden?
Now, Reckoning with Torture, featuring Robert Redford and Paul Auster. Reckoning with Torture is a collaborative film project between Doug Lyman, director of The Bourne Identity, the ACLU, and Pan American Center that examines the human cost of America's post-9/11 torture program. This excerpt features a collage of readings of testimonies by torture victims and witnesses, introduced by Robert Redford, and then author Paul Auster reading Manners of Death, Homicide, excerpts from autopsy reports of detainees held in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan from December 2002 to November 2004.
I am reading an excerpt from a declaration of Lieutenant Colonel Darrell Vanderbilt, former lead prosecutor in the military commission case of Guantanamo detainee Mohammed Jawad.
The records reflected 112 unexplained moves from cell to cell over a two-week period. I lacked the words to express the heart sickness I experienced when I came to understand the pointless, purely gratuitous mistreatment of Mr. Jawad by my fellow soldiers.
Holding Mr. Jawad for 6 years with no resolution of his case, with no terminus in sight, is something beyond a travesty.
We're reading an excerpted transcript of former CIA Director George Tenet's 60 Minutes appearance in April of 2007.
I'm going to read from the sworn statement of an interpreter at the Kandahar Detention Facility in Afghanistan.
I was handcuffed, blindfolded, and taken to a building where I was severely beaten.
The detainee was almost unconscious on the floor with a pile of hair next to him. He had apparently been literally pulling his own hair out throughout the night.
The detainee is securely shackled and is deprived of sight and sound through the use of blindfolds, earmuffs, and hoods. The rest of the page is redacted.
America stands against and will not tolerate torture.
You have informed us that you expect these techniques to be used in some sort of escalating fashion, culminating with the waterboard.
This procedure triggers an automatic physiological sensation of drowning that the individual cannot control, even though he may be aware that he is, in fact, not drowning.
They stripped us down naked and they tied a hand behind our backs.
After 37 days without food, I was dragged into an interrogation room where a feeding tube was forced through my nose into my stomach. I was extremely ill.
Lee played the call to prayer with a special alarm clock. Detainee was told, "This is no longer the call to prayer. You are not allowed to pray. This is a call to interrogation."
Then the real torturing started.
It was difficult to breathe.
I don't want to ask you about the evidence because you said the evidence was classified. But how can I respond to this? It is not a question and it is not an accusation.
They want answers which you can't give them because you have no involvement in anything.
Detainee became increasingly tired and incoherent. He slept for 1 hour, followed by 1 hour in his chair listening to white noise.
What you're essentially saying is some people need to be tortured.
No, I didn't say that.
You call it in the book enhanced interrogation technique.
Well, that's what we call it.
I mean, that's a euphemism.
I'm not having a semantic debate with you. I'm telling you what I believe.
On another occasion, the AC had been turned off, making the temperature in the unventilated room probably well over 100 degrees.
Anyone ever die in the interrogation program?
No.
You're sure of that?
What, the program that you and I are discussing? No.
I'm Paul Oster, and I'll be reading excerpts from a series of autopsy and death reports of detainees who died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan. Autopsy number A03-51, date of death, June 6, 2003. Decedent is a 52-year-old Iraqi male, civilian detainee, who was found unresponsive outside in isolation at Whitehorse Detainment Facility. This 52-year-old male, redacted, died as a result of asphyxia, lack of oxygen to the brain, due to strangulation. Additional findings at autopsy include blunt force injuries, predominantly recent bruises on the torso and lower extremities. The abrasions encircling the left wrist are consistent with the use of restraints. Cause of death, strangulation. Manner of death, homicide. Autopsy number ME03-504, date of death, November 4th, 2003. An Iraqi national died while detained at the Abu Ghraib prison, where he was held for interrogations by government agencies. Fractures of the ribs and a contusion of the left lung imply significant blunt force injuries of the thorax and likely resulted in impaired respiration. Interviews taken from individuals present during the interrogation indicate that a hood was placed over the head and neck of the detainee. This likely resulted in further compromise of effective respiration. Cause of death, blunt force injuries complicated by compromised respiration. Manner of death, homicide. Autopsy number ME03-571. Date of death, November 26, 2003. This Iraqi died while in U.S. custody. The details surrounding the circumstances at the time of death are classified. Cause of death, asphyxia due to smothering and chest compression. Manner of death, homicide.
death, April 5, 2004, location LSA Damon. Questioned by NSWT, struggled, interrogated, died sleeping. Cause and manner pending. Death, January 1, 2004, location FOB Rifles. Questioned by other government agency, gagged and standing restraint. Cause, blunt force injuries and asphyxia. Manner of death, homicide. Death, November 26, 2004, location FOB Tiger. Questioned by military intelligence, died during interrogation. Cause, asphyxia due to smothering and chest compression. Manner of death, homicide. Death, November 4, 2003, location Abu Ghraib. Questioned by other government agency and NSWT, died during interrogation. Cause, blunt force injury complicated by compromised respiration. Manner of death, homicide. Death, December 10, 2002, location Bagram, Afghanistan. Found unresponsive in cell. Cause, blunt force injuries to lower extremities. Manner of death, homicide. Death, December 3, 2002, location Bagram, Afghanistan. Found unresponsive, restrained in his cell. Cause, pulmonary embolism due to blunt force injuries to the legs. Manner of death, homicide. Autopsy number ME04-14. Date of death, January 9, 2004. Iraqi detainee died while in U.S. custody. This 47-year-old white male died of blunt force injuries and asphyxia. The autopsy disclosed multiple blunt force injuries, including deep contusions of the chest wall, numerous displaced rib fractures, lung contusions, and hemorrhage into the intestine. The decedent was shackled to the top of a doorframe with a gag in his mouth at the time he lost consciousness and became pulseless. The severe blunt force injuries, the hanging position, and the obstruction of the oral cavity with a gag contributed to this individual's death. The manner of death is homicide.
For more information and many more excerpts from Reckoning with Torture, go to www.reckoningwithtorture.org.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.